Today we are exploring the intersection between ecology and technology in the form of a company that has developed a complete off-grid toolkit for operating a farm anywhere there's land and some water. We're speaking with the co-founder of Farm from a Box today, a beautiful marriage between ecology and technology, here on Inorganic Conversation, your show on everything that makes life worth living. I'm Helge Hellberg. There are plenty of challenges to food production, including access to land, the availability of clean water, and the right infrastructure so that the farm can be functional and productive for months and years to come. For example, access to electrical power for irrigation pumps, a cooler for appropriate post-harvest handling, and so much more. There's a company that set out to solve that challenge, and they've succeeded by creating a completely self-sufficient model of a movable energy farming center, which can be used in inner cities anywhere in the US as well as in any other situation on this planet, as long as there's land and water available. And the co-founder is with us today, Brandy DeCarli, in this hour of an organic conversation, Farm from a Box, a beautiful marriage between ecology and technology. All that and more coming up in just a minute here in an organic conversation. I'm Helge Hellberg, and this show is brought to you by Equal Exchange, a worker-owned cooperative that ensures your food is environmentally sound and socially just. Equal Exchange has been creating big change for small farmers for over 30 years by offering certified organic and fair trade coffee, tea, chocolate, bananas, and avocados. More on Equal Exchange at equalexchange.coop. That's equalexchange.coop. And by Udderly, offering beautiful and fun clothing for boys and girls that is made entirely from the unused fabric of prominent apparel manufacturers. Each garment reduces our eco-footprint by preventing this fabric from reaching the waste stream. Udderly, making sustainability fashionable and fashion sustainable. For more information, udderly.co. That's UTTERLY.co. And we're back here to an organic conversation. I'm Helge Hellberg. It's time to explore the intersection between ecology and technology. There's a company that set out to solve the challenge of a movable farm center. And with me now is the co-founder of that organization, Farm from a Box. In this episode of An Organic Conversation, a beautiful marriage between ecology and technology. That's Brandy DeCarli, the founding partner of Farm from a Box. Brandy, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
When I saw your concept, I really felt for the first time, this is what technology should be used for. There are so many areas of technology where we learn afterwards what was challenging, what didn't work, you know, the dangers of integrating phones as the new center of our lives. And yet you have so elegantly found a way to using the cutting edge of technology to support, in this case, food production, nature, ecology. What did you recognize as a need to birth the concept of Farm from a Box?
Really, it's coming down to a lack of infrastructure to support locally grown sustainable farming. I think when my business partner and I first started working together several years ago, we were working on a project in Kenya. And we found that the community was really struggling with not only healthy access to food, but also just basic infrastructure that could really support a reliable crop growth. The project that we were working on was actually not necessarily anything to do with farming, but it was a youth empowerment center. But we were utilizing modified shipping containers built around a soccer field to bring in basic resources to the area. So it was very focused on education, health, and sport. But once we sort of stepped back, all of those things are very necessary. But if there still isn't proper nutrition access in the area, then we've got another problem that we have to address.
What were you supplying then? What was in those shipping containers?
Oh, it was, we modified the containers to be a basic classroom or a basic health clinic. And we wanted to make sure that we could utilize the containers to deliver this sort of youth empowerment center pretty quickly and be able to get that up and running directly around a soccer field. So when we started to address the food issue, we started to really think, okay, how is it that we could take the same model that a shipping container can allow and make it a plug-and-play food container system that could actually support local growth? And so that's what we did.
Cool. So tell us about how does it work? What does it look like if somebody was really to envision this? And we'll put it up on Facebook, of course, with photos when we list this show. But if you describe it, we're talking shipping container. There are two different sizes, a 20-foot and a 40-footer. What is this if you had to visualize it?
Yes, it's a funny thing. When people hear farm from a box, they're like, oh, are you delivering things on our doorstep?
Well,
No. The box is very large. So we are working with a 20-foot shipping container right now is our core model. So if you can imagine a 20-foot shipping container where on the top of the container, we have 3 kilowatts of solar energy. That solar power ends up providing power to a submersible water pump that will move the water out through a 2-acre field through micro drip irrigation lines. Inside of the container is basically the hub of all of the technology that serves the entire farm. So we also have the inverters, the off-grid power storage area in terms of the batteries. In the back section of the container, we have an internal cold storage unit for being able to keep the crops cooler longer. We also have basic tools. So there's a little workbench. We have Wi-Fi connectivity. We like to refer to it affectionately as a Swiss Army knife of sustainable farming.
And that's exactly what it
the box
like.
Is definitely the hub for this.
Can people grow seeds, for example, out? Like how much space do you get in a 20-foot shipping container? 20 feet sounds fair, but it's limited. I mean, you needed to rethink every inch of that space, right? Between post-harvest handling cooler that needs to be substantial but small enough to allow other space, batteries, equipment. How packed is that?
It has taken us some time to come up with the design, suffice it to say. Everything is really planned. You know, for people that are familiar with a VW camper van, I grew up going camping with my father.
And I'm German. Thank you for that
example.
Okay,
perfect. Everything inside of a VW camper van is very compact. It's thought out and it's efficient in its spacing.
Yes.
So we really sort of took that same filter in how it is that we were designing the space for maximum efficiency with a 20-foot shipping container. So that definitely informed some of the ways in which we designed this. But we also wanted to make sure that it was compact enough that for trucking purposes, a 40-foot shipping container can certainly limit what type of fields we may be able to put this in. So we wanted it to be light, compact, and really efficient.
How long did it take you to come up with a design where you felt, yeah, this is optimal use? Or is this ongoing work? Are you still looking at it constantly and refining it?
I think we will always be looking at it constantly and refining it. Once you really have the first few units out there, it's
sure,
you
learn
continue
by doing,
to look
right?
and do, yeah. and then you continually look and innovate and improve.
Sure.
So I think that will be a part of our adventure that lies ahead of us is how is it that we can take this model but continually improve it and continually do it in ways where it can also be applied to different areas. One important distinction to make is that there are a number of different containerized food production systems out there, but most of them are all hydroponically grown leafy greens utilizing the inside of the container for the growth. We flipped it inside out. So we're using the container to hold all of the infrastructure and almost act as that barn on site, if you will, a technologically encased barn. But all of the growth is happening on the 2 acres outside of the barn. So we can do seedlings in an attach-on greenhouse shade house area to be able to directly plant into the field. But we like to really make sure that we're using sun and soil so that you can grow any crop that you're looking to be able to grow through this system.
Yeah, great. I mean, with hydroponics, and we had shows on that before, indoor growing lights and all that, it's amazing what can be done in houses. But I'm a soil advocate. So while that is impressive, for me, it's missing. Even if you add the nutrients, there's so many things we don't understand or we haven't researched yet. Soil is soil, and there's nothing else like it. And just as, you know, we were told, if you eat these vitamins, you should be fine, there are things we keep exploring or keep finding. Bioflavonoids, vitamin C was just a few decades ago unknown before. So I agree with you that the virtue of growing in direct soil, also 2 acres, while productivity in growing indoors may be fairly high, 1 20-foot shipping container can, you said 2 acres? Can
2 acres, correct.
Irrigate and have the energy and the infrastructure for 2 acres
exactly,
of land.
Exactly. It produces a lot of crop. 2 acres is a bit of a sweet spot where it's a good size for a community farm. It's manageable enough for a group of family farmers to be able to grow. And it's not too big where you start really needing to get into mechanized equipment or, you know,
tractors,
a lot of people.
And all that stuff.
It's enough where you can really do a really good job and have an incredibly productive.
What does that mean? In other words, what was it designed for? Who is the solution designed for? Mostly refugee camps, small urban communities, other emergency situations. What did you have in mind when you came up with this idea?
You know, it's interesting when you say that, because all of the above is what really applies now. But at the genesis of the idea, the very genesis, if I may say, the Kenya project was where the idea really came up, in terms of how can we bridge that missing infrastructure gap by providing a deliverable system that could really have sustained, reliable crop growth there within the community. As we started diving into it a little bit more, then we really saw, well, wait a minute, how can we actually have an alternative to standard food aid by being able to provide communities the tools that they need to grow their own crop? And so that was actually the genesis, is how is it, can this really be able to serve people that need to grow their own food? And it has evolved, as things always do. So it absolutely still serves that purpose. Refugee camps is absolutely one of them, but it also serves a really beautiful way of being able to involve people in the food that they are eating and how it's grown. So it's beautiful for schools, for urban farms, for food deserts, for rural areas. We're finding that a lot of people that already have land would like to be able to make productive use out of it and be able to grow their own sustainable crops for their own consumption, but also be able to sell whatever, you know, they need for income generation purposes too. So it's interesting. It's a bit of a chameleon. It can serve many different purposes. And I think that there's a very real need for localizing our food production, both domestically and globally.
I'm with Brandy DeCarli. She is the founding partner of Farm From a Box. That's farmfromabox.com, the website. In this hour of Farm From a Box, a beautiful marriage between ecology and technology. We're talking about a 20-foot shipping container, movable barn that provides all the electricity and infrastructure needed, as long as there's land and water, to create and be productive as a small-scale, hands-on, 2-acre-plus farm, which is an interesting timing that you picked, or life picked you to develop this, however we want to see that. But we are losing about 50% of our agricultural base in the next 10 years, right? There are lots of farmers that have reached or are reaching retirement age here in the U.S. We have 2 million family farms left, and we know that about 1 million will be lost in the next 10 years. Nobody really is talking about that. And with that retirement also comes the question of what will happen to the land. Most of the time, it might be sold or developed, and it will be lost as agricultural land forever. We have about 30 to 50,000 new young farmers in ag schools or getting into agriculture right now, which is wonderful, but only a fraction of what's needed. with your concept, you are allowing access to land that otherwise, without infrastructure or municipality or electricity grid, could not be farmed. Did you realize that when you started this concept, or do you see the need now for USDA? You are basically the solution for ag land access in the U.S., which is maybe the biggest problem we have. Young farmers, the number one thing they say, other than, you know, getting loans without equity and or assets, but access to land is the number one topic that I hear about. Were you aware of that?
Access to land is a big one, and we weren't necessarily looking at that at the onset of this, but we're now seeing a huge demand for that. And you're absolutely right. The aging farmer population that we're facing is a really big deal. And so how is it that we can also reignite interest in farming, but also reignite interest in farming that is sustainably grown, healthy food production that really utilizes resources wisely? We can't continue to farm in a lot of the ways that we have been farming. Here in California, I mean, we're certainly dealing with it now with flood irrigation and limited access to water. We've got to be able to look at things from a little bit of a different path. And I think, thankfully, technology can serve a dual role in that, making sure that the small farms are really efficient, really productive, but can also really get the interest of a younger generation and get them involved. And technology can play a key role in that, too.
How long did it take you to from the first idea to this mature state of having a 20-foot shipping container that basically meets all the needs of a 2-acre production barn, plus the energy providing that on top of it?
We've been working on this for 3 years, pretty intensely 3 years, too.
I would have not been surprised if you had said 10. So if you feel that's long, it feels short to me.
I think it's only because we've lived and breathed this so intensely for years. It's taken us some time, really being able to examine, okay, what are those core components that really need to be integrated into this? And then when you look at growing outdoors, there are so many different variables to agriculture. So
around the world.
Exactly.
I mean, if you really have a worldwide application.
So how do you really honor that? How do you make sure that through that lens of localization, how do we honor the local climate, what the soil condition is, what the water access point is, what the local culture is? So I've already said the analogy of Swiss Army knife, but I'm going to throw another one in there. And I think going through this is we've had to keep the product really dynamic to be able to respond to a lot of those variables. So we can plug in and plug out different components.
Oh, so it's modular, like you can.
It's modular, but almost Lego style, where to make sure that we have a unit work for a certain area, you know, we figure out, all right, what is your water access point? What is it that you're looking to be able to grow? Where is the farm going to be? Who's it going to be for? And we can actually custom tailor the unit a little bit to make sure that it's responding to that too.
That's phenomenal. And of course, I know that the irrigation, for example, everything at that farm box can be run through your cell phone or much of it. And yet there might be areas in the world where there is no cell phone or there is no internet. So having it be modular or individually designable to some degree is a huge asset, of course, in a worldwide application.
Absolutely. And to your point, in terms of not necessarily having access to cellular, that's one thing that we wanted to make sure that we included in all of these boxes, is we live in a very connected world now. And so in order to be able to really utilize technology and also get information accessed, we wanted to make sure that each box was connected live. So whether that's connecting to Wi-Fi via cellular access or via satellite, that's also something that we include in the box so that there's information access and that you can track and monitor the performance of the system even remotely.
Cool. Excellent. Wonderful. Farm from a box, a beautiful marriage between ecology and technology. With me is Brandy DeCarli, the founding partner of Farm from a Box. Again, that's farmfromabox.com. This is an organic conversation. I'm Helge Hellberg, and we'll take a quick break to honor our underwriters. We'll be right back with so much more. This show is brought to you by Bowman College, a leader in the field of holistic nutrition and culinary arts. Become a nutrition consultant or a natural chef at one of their campuses, or learn from home in a self-paced mentored distance learning program. For more information on a degree in holistic nutrition or culinary arts, bowmancollege.org. and Frey Vineyards, America's first organic winery, family-owned and operated. Dedicated to the highest levels of organic and biodynamic farming, Frey never adds synthetic sulfites or other preservatives to their wines. Award-winning wines at freywine.com. That's FreyWine.com. And thank you also to Earl's Organic Produce, a national distributor of organic fruits and vegetables that has been sourcing solely organic produce for over 20 years. From grocery store to company cafeteria to caterers and personal chefs, anyone can buy from Earl's Organic. Certified organic produce at earlsorganic.com. Back here to an organic conversation. I'm Helge Hellberg. Our topic is the exploration of the intersection between ecology and technology. There's an amazing concept. It's called Farm from a Box. It's a 20-foot shipping container that can be individualized to meet the farming needs, electricity, and so much more for any piece of land that has access to some water anywhere around the world. And we're speaking with the founding partner, Brandy DeCarli, today here in this episode. Brandy, we talked about the different applications of it. For me, that's the form as a function. What are you doing the most, you feel? Are you educating? Are you feeding? Are you building community or building resilience? What is it?
I keep answering your questions with all of the above, and I think that's just actually
it's
an accurate answer. So we're absolutely doing all of those things. I mean, when you really think about local farms and when you think about sustainable food production, it is educating. It is building community. It is making sure that there is health that's in the community. But you're also empowering people to be able to have much more choice with what it is that they actually consume, but empowering people to be able to really make a sustainable income off of the land that they have. So it's a little bit of all of the above.
I love that. And with income, of course, comes the question of cost. A 2-acre piece of land, of course, depending on where it is and what you grow. But how much does a shipping container like that in its normal configuration, whatever that exactly means, but what's the range of costs for somebody who's interested in purchasing one, and how much food value are you able roughly to create with it?
Yeah, it's a good question. So each one of our units right now, and again, we can tailor it to match whatever the situation is on the ground, but they range right now from about $50,000 to $55,000, depending on whether or not you get the fully Cadillac version with the whole IoT system and sensors and all of that.
The VW bus.
I'm making things a little bit more complex here, but yes. And we can make sure that from that, the system is crop agnostic. So it can support any type of crop that the farmer is really looking to do. And that provides maximum flexibility. So whether a farmer is looking to grow crops more for consumption and nutrition, it will support that. If you're looking to just grow cash crops for income generation, it can support that, or even better yet, a combination of the two. So I think off of about a 2-acre plot of land, we like to say as a baseline that can feed about 150 people a year with about 110 pounds of produce. I'm sorry, I'm using American standards here in terms of what the measurements are.
That's great.
But it's quite a bit of food.
And what would that mean in value? In other words, how many years would you grow in order to even have paid for the shipping container itself.
Yeah, that would also depend on what it is that you're growing. But we like to state that you can, safe bet would probably be making 100,000, 130,000 off of each one of these farms on an annual basis. So you'd be able to buy back the farm pretty quickly.
That means, in other words, that even in not ideal conditions, roughly within a year, definitely within 2 years, the box will pay for itself.
Yes.
That's kind of unheard as a solution to areas where no food production is possible without that electricity grid and the irrigation pumps and all that.
It is. And since we're putting all of these components in the box that are meant to last for years, we want to make sure that the durability is there. So it's an investment on the front end, but you're going to have continued production year after year thereafter. And since it's an independent system that doesn't require grid access, that also lowers any sort of ongoing costs that you have from there as well.
Which brings us, you just returned from Africa, literally 2 weeks ago,
yes,
something like that. What's the project there you're working on right now? What's the interest of the, I understand the interest in the farming world, but I'm looking from a humanitarian perspective of UNICEF to United Nations. This is kind of the solution to world hunger. Instead of shipping boxes and bags of rice and beans, this would empower communities, as you say, for years to be self-sustainable.
It enables people to be agents of their own well-being, especially when it comes to nutritional access. So,
and it's their local production, right? Rice and beans sounds like a great food for us, and many cultures around the world eat it, but they know best what they can grow within their growing conditions.
Right.
Their original foods, where they maybe still have seeds. They don't really need our help if we empower them to be, self-sufficient. What's that project in Africa, and what is that interest of the world community?
The project is pretty phenomenal. So I'm really excited about it. I still beam thinking about it. We have teamed up with the United Nations World Food Program to launch one of these units in Tanzania. And what we're doing with this one is really, it's really unique. It's the first time that we've really taken an approach like this. And it's the first time that the World Food Program's really taken an approach like this of utilizing this technology as an innovation center and bringing together both refugees and host communities together to be able to have a good, solid production and working in unison. So I'll try to explain that a little bit more simply, because I've been learning along the way with this. But in refugee camps, and we know that there are too many of them around the world with nearly 70 million refugees globally, what happens in a refugee camp, and especially in a protracted refugee situation where refugees are literally stateless within a refugee camp for upwards of 20, 25 years, you don't really have the opportunity to farm or have fresh food access. The rations that they are provided are quite literally just meant to be able to sustain their lives. So there's issues with malnutrition. And there's also issues with dignity and really being able to give people a shot at being able to get back on their feet again.
And maybe resentment from the communities who took those refugees on because they need to be supported.
Exactly.
Right? Not that they don't want to, but it's straining their resources too.
It strains their resources.
There's no real project that lets them interact, right?
Precisely. They've been separated populaces. And mm-hmm. to your point, exactly, in the host community, in our case in Tanzania, we are working way over on the eastern side of Tanzania along the border of the Congo and Burundi. And this area, the surrounding communities struggle with food insecurity and malnutrition as well. And so when they constantly see they have water, but they don't have the infrastructure. Uh-huh. So it's still dependent on rain-fed agriculture. And our climate is changing. And so the rains are not coming when the rains have typically come. And when they do come, they come down in torrents. So there's different ways in which we may be able to look at really stabilizing this. But then add in a refugee populace, and it really can complicate a situation. So with the World Food Program, we're creating this innovation center where this unit is going to be situated just outside of the refugee camp in a surrounding host community called Kalimungoma. And in this project, we're really going to focus on growing a healthy crop production with a broader range of crops so that we can increase dietary diversity. And we can make sure that those crops can go up for sale so that both the refugees and host community members that are going to be farming on this project together get access to those crops, but can also sell them for income. But it also lends itself really well to peaceful cohesion, which is probably the third and almost more important indicator that we have with this.
That's so great. We just had a show on a new documentary. It's called The Age of Consequences. It's about the geopolitical impact of global warming, how it's an amplifier to crises anywhere in the world, destabilizing areas, the, as you said, movement of 70 million people as refugees, the strain it takes on communities, and how terrorism is bred out of that. Lots of men have nothing to do, and there's conflict brewing. So in a way, this is at the center of peace work, what you're doing.
Absolutely. And we're extremely, extremely proud about that because, I mean, at the very core, we all generally want the same exact things. We want to be able to eat, we want to be able to be free, and we want to be able to
productive
love and be productive.
That's right.
And so in communities that are really struggling with that and within the refugee crisis, dignity can really be stripped away when you aren't given those tools to be able to take care of yours and your family needs. So we're really excited about this. And actually, I just want to share one other thing, too. With all of the projects that we have, we like to have the end community or the organization or whomever gets these units name the box so that there's a little bit of a soul to it. So, for example, our first unit we named Adam. We were being a little cheeky with that one.
Why not Eve?
Well, there was a longer story to that one. Otherwise, I would have gone for Eve out of the gate.
Since this is an organic conversation,
correct.
I would
correct.
Veto that, but yeah.
We also just landed a unit in West Sacramento working with the IRC, the International Rescue Committee, working with resettled refugees that are coming here to the United States. And the refugees here for this project are coming from Bhutan and Nepal primarily. And so when we gave them the opportunity to name their unit, they came up with the name Karma. So this World Food Program project, you know, we came up to the refugees and the host community and we said, all right, well, we would really like for you to be able to name your unit as well. They deliberate on it for a little while and then they give us this slip of paper and it reads Kalimungoma, which is the name of the village, Ushirikiano. And we look and we're like, well, what does Ushirikiano mean? It's Swahili for the spirit of togetherness. So really, I think the refugees and the host community members really see that peace aspect of this project is really important too. And so much so that they actually named the unit the Spirit of Togetherness in honor of that.
That's so beautiful. And we are talking about kitchen table talks and we are talking about breaking bread. And in this case, it's creating bread that then can be broken together. Farm from a box, a beautiful marriage between ecology and technology. That's our topic in this hour of an organic conversation. And I'm joined here in the studio by Brandy DeCarli, the founding partner of Farm from a Box. That's farmfromabox.com. That's a great story. Thank you for sharing that. And can you share a couple more? What else have you seen this farm to be used? What interests, what inquiries have you had? What's the feedback so far?
On the topic, since I just brought up the IRC farm, Karma, I'll speak a little bit about that one.
The Karma Box.
The Karma Box. There's a song for that one, I'm sure.
Yeah.
You know, it's an interesting way when you speak about being able to really make the bread and break the bread together. That particular farm with the IRC is in the middle of a housing development in a pretty suburban area of West Sacramento. And so when you imagine refugees coming from Bhutan and Nepal suddenly ending up in West Sacramento, there's a bit of a culture shock that's there. So how do you...
Why? No, I'm kidding.
it's a bit of a stretch.
I don't see that. Yes.
So how is it that you can really make sure that you're building community within this new community that they're calling home? So,
and what we can learn from them.
Exactly.
Right? I mean, and so it goes in all directions.
Exactly, exactly. And so that shared learning that can take place, that's exactly what's happening with this farm. And so it's been really wonderful for us to be able to see this grow. The box serves as a means for the refugees to not only grow food for their own consumption, but there's also partnerships that have been formed with local restaurants and chefs. So to your point exactly, there are crops that are grown on the farm that are traditional Nepali crops or are traditional peppers that are from Bhutan, and these peppers are phenomenal. So local chefs are actually purchasing some of these crops and integrating them into their menu items because it's new and it's a different flavor. So there is this sharing that's going on. And even directly within the community, because within this direct housing sort of community that is by the farm, They can purchase crops directly there at the farm stand. So the refugees are getting to know literally the local community and vice versa. And there's this really beautiful exchange of knowledge and cultures that happens well.
What are your plans for the future? What are your priorities? What's the next 2 years or so for Farm from a Box?
Oh, well, strategically, I'll start with the hardline one first. Strategically, we are now just really starting to get our running legs on in that we're commercially expanding and providing these units at a much quicker level to interested buyers.
How quickly is that? If somebody ordered one, or if UNICEF said we need 10, how quickly can you assemble those?
Now, it's interesting. So I think commercially for the retail center, if you will, retail center, for our retail sales, we're focusing on the U.S. right now, with the exception of some larger scale projects that we can do with the likes of the World Food Program, UNICEF, and UNHCR, other organizations. So we're doing those ones on the side right now because we want to be able to scale out enough so that we can make sure that we're still there with each one of these farmers and really supporting them through it as well. From the non-strategic side, if you will, I think where we are is keeping our eyes still completely wide open. There's a number of different areas that we're still looking into, one being establishing some of these units and putting them in Native American reservations. Globally, we're looking at expanding and putting regionalized manufacturing and assembly hubs in different areas so that not only we're localizing the growth, but we're actually localizing the business as well.
Even internationally?
Absolutely internationally. Oh. Mm-hmm. So even with the World Food Program project that we're doing in Tanzania, we've set up local in-country manufacturing of the units so that we can contribute to local jobs also directly there in Tanzania. So that
even
takes a little bit of time to develop.
A shipping container is the perfect form, obviously. I mean, there's, you know, from housing to shipping containers have finally been acknowledged as an amazingly impactful unit and powerful and all that. But the point is, it's an existing form that can be shipped in on a boat in 3 weeks anywhere in the world. And it's standardized, right? That's the point.
It's absolutely
standardized. Makes it so applicable.
And they're everywhere. So
that's right.
Really being able to utilize what's already existing there within the country and within the community, then it's just a matter of really localizing the supply chains and strengthening those supply chains as well.
But you are touching on an interesting point that I didn't see. It's not for you to just crank out the Farm from a Box boxes. It's for you to stay involved in that. And you are not a nonprofit. It looks like to me the work of an internationally acting huge nonprofit that could then stay involved ongoingly for years to come with those communities, with each individual box, learning from the box, learning from the community, so that the box is the center, but it's only the form of the function of peace building or, you know, collaboration. Where do you draw the line there? How much can be done?
That's exactly it. And I think what we are is we're a for-profit benefit corporation. So from the outside, it really could look like we're doing the work of a nonprofit, but we're a market-based engine. And so being able to sell these units is the engine for being able to keep the impact going. So I think now things are really evolving when it comes to those blurred lines between nonprofit and for-profit.
Totally. Mm-hmm.
And so we want to be a for-profit that sort of looks like a nonprofit and that we're doing sustainable work, but we make sure that we have not only a financial bottom line as a business, but that's what will keep the business going in the long run as well. So environmental impact, social impact, and being a financially solvent company.
Amazing. Where can people learn more? What's the best source? Your website, farmfromabox.com?
Yeah, website is absolutely a good source. We're going to be putting some more information on the website shortly. Twitter is also another way. I'm pretty active on Twitter, so you're welcome to be able to send over some messages that way. Facebook also. And there's email access, and you can contact us directly through the website should anybody have any questions.
That's amazing. That's farmfromabox.com, the website. Brandy DeCarli, the founding partner of Farm from a Box, a 20-foot shipping container that is the solution, not just to farming, but even as the center for peace building and community for any agricultural or land-based challenge that we face, which in one way or another, you can trace down every challenge that we face. As societies around the world, it's around food production and land access. Thank you so much for making the time to come into the studio with me today. And you just returned from Africa, so I appreciate it even more. And I know you're going back now, so good luck with all those projects. And
thank
we'll
you.
Have you back soon.
Thank you very, very much. I'm honored to be
Pleasure.
Here and look forward to coming back.
Thank you, Brandy. Take care. And that's Farm from a Box, a beautiful marriage between ecology and technology. We're staying with the topic of food production, as always, the update from the world of produce, healthy fruits and vegetables from the San Francisco produce market dock directly. What's in season, what to buy, what to choose it, how to store it, what to do with it. Here is what's in season. And with me now is the voice of the San Francisco produce dock, Mr. Earl Herrick, also Mr. Organic for the country, giving us the update of what is coming, what's the hottest item for us in the retail store, because he is already handling it. Earl, are you there?
Yes, I am handling it.
Yes.
Wow. Yeah, and there is so much to handle this
time of year. Into May. Oh, so wonderful. The produce departments made it through winter, and it's still amazing what can be produced. And you know, I know much of the produce comes from Mexico at that point, and but the produce department doesn't really look all that different throughout winter. You think it's still rich and abundant, but the difference to now and all the stuff you remember now that you've forgotten is just, right, from snap peas and from, wow, so rich and abundant. And especially with this winter being so wet, it seems like, I don't know, but it seems life is exploding. Every deer has four offspring or three fawns. And so what's happening on the produce dock?
Well, you know, I don't know that we've ever talked about this, and it is something that is all over the country now, and that's farmers markets.
Oh.
And this time of year, you know, halfway through May, most of the farmers markets are open in the areas that they exist. Now, the only ones that may not may be in the far northeast, but even then, many of them get started and they just don't have as much. The big deal, I think, is the experience of it, is that you're outside. You're shopping in this fresh product that somebody just brought there. It's an intimate affair. You get to ask this representative anything you want.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, sampling is beyond even, I mean, they're offering you food as you walk up. And that is really where you get to learn a little bit about the art of how to ask for what you want. And it's not uncommon to say, well, that was wonderful. Can I try a little bit of that? And you should feel absolutely comfortable and confident that, you know, your ability to do that. The fact is, when I go to farmers markets, there's just a whole inclination to buy. You just walk on the premises, and there you are in the midst of all of this abundance, and you're just ready to go.
Yeah,
and
fun.
Mm-hmm. All right there.
Yeah, I just looked up while you were speaking and some statistics from 1994 to 2013, so that's basically 20 years. The number of farmers markets in the U.S. has grown from 1,700, roughly, to over 8,000, and that was 2013. So
yeah.
I'm sure we are past 9,000 at this point at a 4 or 5% growth rate each year. Yeah, you're right. It's community, it's season, it's the local economy, it's really the agricultural producers all in one place, which you never see otherwise at any other place.
Yeah.
If you see them at all, I mean, who really goes to a farm on a regular basis?
Uh-huh.
Only a few people do that. Beautiful. And what are some of the tips that you do? Do you go through the market first and check prices and produce, and then you go back around and then you buy? Or do you know your farms or stalls that you buy from?
Yeah, many of them I do know. Many of them are so small that they don't deal with wholesalers.
Yeah.
They have either you picks or this is their income right there.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really a wonderful opportunity for these growers, because they're able to, the standards get a little more relaxed. So if something has a bird peck or a tree rub on it, not a problem.
Mm-hmm. The money goes straight to them, of course.
It goes straight to them. And they can generally get a little more. So they're selling a number two quality, perhaps, and in no means does that mean that it's terrible. It just means it has a little twig rub, and they're able to get a number one price on it.
Yeah.
And that is how they're able to make their money.
And most farmers, just to reiterate that, most farmers live on a 10 or, you know, 8 or maybe 15% profit margin. So if they have a lot of seconds and they can't, or number twos, and if they can't sell them, that might mean, yes, they sold all the number ones, but they are not making money. They're not making a profit. They're basically just farming for, you know, to keep the farm alive. So selling those seconds, which are qualitatively, flavor-wise and nutrition-wise, completely perfect, makes or breaks the farm often.
Absolutely. And the number two is really just an appearance. It's all eye candy.
Sure.
So if it has a little misshape or something odd about it, it still tastes great. And the proof is right there.
Right.
You get a taste. You know, what's cool, too, about a farmer's market this early is you get to see all the early stuff that you probably are not going to see later. So this is when a lot of strawberries are around. And I still feel the best strawberries you can find are the ones at the farmer's market.
Well, strawberries are one of those many items where a day makes a difference. And there's nothing fresher than a farmer's market, because often the stuff was literally picked the afternoon before, or maybe even early in the morning before the market, right?
That's right. And they're letting it ripen. You're picking it later
in their
maturity, because they know it's going to be sold and eaten that day. And also, you want to be able to have that ripe strawberry to give a sample. And if you waited a little bit too long and they got a little bruised, those are the ones you sample.
Yeah.
So, you know, that, again, like I said, the strawberries are the best at a farmer's market. They're not going to go through a hydro cooling. They don't have to worry about shipping it up to Seattle or anything.
That's so nice that you, as a wholesaler, can say, you know, yes, absolutely, visit your farmer's market. It's not competition for you, even though technically it is, but there's enough demand of organic produce to absolutely support your farmer at a farmer's market and still buy organic at the store for anything that you couldn't get.
Yeah, I mean, there's enough for all of us. You got to support the farms. I mean, many of the farms that I do have relationships with and buy the product, they also do farmers markets.
Yeah.
That's part of their diversification that they really, really need to survive.
And it's not just farmers, actually, right? I mean, farmers in the widest sense. There's local fishermen. There's local honey.
People.
There's local
baked goods.
Yes.
You know, as a matter of fact, this time of year, sometimes those merchants outweigh the farmers, because some farmers are still in production
and haven't
come into full production. The other thing I like to find there is the little greens that you only find in the spring, and the different crest, the different baby chards, and all these arugulas and all these other mosh, all these very tender greens that before it gets too hot, before the days are long and the sun is beating down on them, you have this the shorter day, the milder day, and you get all this tender green stuff. It is a lot of fun to go there and shop for that.
And in volume, they would never make it through wholesale, because they just have, you know, four cases of that. And of course, they sell it at the farmer's market. Again, what's the best tip to get the best produce, or in a way, the best, best produce for the best price?
Shop early.
Oh, I thought it's shop late. It makes sense to get the best quality to shop early, but price-wise, I thought
shop
at
late.
The end they throw out what they can to sell it.
Well, there's no doubt shopping late, but of course there's a high risk there.
Yeah.
One is they may be done. you may miss it, but it's been sitting out unrefrigerated all day.
Oh, that's true. Good point.
But there are some things definitely especially now if you're doing pies or you're canning, shopping late is fine. Another thing to do is get in a relationship with these growers and say, hey, next week when you come in the farmer's market, can you bring, I'd like to get a flat of strawberries or a flat of peaches.
Uh-huh. Here's my name.
And if you've been doing it for a while, of course they know you. And then bingo, right there, you're set for the week.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't have to worry about it. And plus, you're creating a relationship with a grower that is not to be forgotten.
Or eggs, like things that are always selling out, right?
You don't need to
rush to the farmer's market if you can say, that put just a dozen aside for me next week, here's my name.
Yeah, I had forgotten about eggs. Of course, eggs.
Yeah, it's definitely amazing. Now that I think about farmer's markets, everything, really. You can even get meats and, you know, of course, fish and all that stuff.
And then there's always musicians there.
Sure, so fun.
Of course, you know, there's clowns, there's all sorts of things going on.
Do you walk through it first entirely, take a look, and then you go back, or do you shop? That's always the only big question for me. Some markets are so big that making a round for 45 minutes and then coming back and taking note and coming back and shopping at that point. How do you do it?
It really depends. One is how familiar I am with this market. If it's a new market, I'm just going to walk through and
take a first look.
It.
Yeah.
The other thing is how busy is it?
Uh-huh.
I mean, some of these places, they have rock and roll growers there, and their line goes on forever.
Uh-huh.
And so it really depends upon that. If I see something that I think is I'm definitely going to want that, I'm not going to walk by it, because I know either the line is going to grow or they're going to sell out. Again, also it depends if I have a purpose for my shopping beyond just a pleasurable.
Oh yeah, of course. If you have a party or something, barbecue, and you need the item, then
exactly.
Amazing.
So really, get out there now. Get your feet wet. Find some new growers. Get to appreciate them. Bring them a cup of coffee. Get to know them.
Yes, and we herewith officially kicked off the 2017 Farmers Market season.
Ha. There you go.
How did that feel? Amazing. Thank you, Earl. And I can't wait to have you back next week. And whatever that item will be, summer is here.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you.
Okay.
Good talking to you. Talk soon. Take care. Bye.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a packed hour of hope and inspiration. Farm from a Box, a beautiful marriage between ecology and technology, with Brandy DeCarli, and of course the update from the San Francisco Produce Doc, What's in Season. I'm Helge Hellberg. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll be back with another episode next week. And that was this week's edition of An Organic Conversation. Thank you so much for listening. A big thank you also to our associate producer, Kristen Ponger. An Organic Conversation is made possible through listeners like you and the fantastic support of our underwriters. Equal Exchange. Equal Exchange has been creating big change for small farmers for over 30 years by offering certified organic and fair trade coffee, tea, chocolate, bananas, and avocados. More on Equal Exchange at equalexchange.coop. And Utterly, offering beautiful and fun clothing for boys and girls that is made entirely from the unused fabric of prominent apparel manufacturers, making sustainability fashionable and fashion sustainable. For more information, utterly.co. Also, Earl's Organic Produce, a national distributor providing certified organic fruits and vegetables for your store, home, or business. Anyone can buy directly from Earl's Organic at wholesale prices. The website is earlsorganic.com. And Fry Vineyards, America's first certified organic winery, producing organic and certified biodynamic wine without synthetic sulfites or other preservatives. For more information, frywine.com. Lastly, thank you as well to Bowman College, focused on holistic nutrition and culinary arts for over 20 years. Their website is bowmancollege.org. That's B-A-U-M-A-N college.org. If you missed parts of this show or for any other episode, go to anorganicconversation.com or subscribe to our show on iTunes, Stitcher, or Google Play, so you'll never miss an episode. I'm Helge Hellberg, and we'll be back with another great episode right here, same place, same time, next week. See you then.